AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. The 23-year-old accused of killing one TSA agent and wounding two others at the Los Angeles airport could face the death penalty if convicted. Federal prosecutors have filed murder and other charges against Paul Ciancia. Ana Hernandez, wife of the TSA agent killed, tells reporters her husband was a joyful man.
Gerardo was a great man who always showed his love for our family. He was always there to help anyone in need and always made people laugh with his wonderful sense of humor.
We are back on standard time, and while it took just a bit to change the clocks, your body clock may need a little more time to adjust. Dr. Shelby Harris is a behavioral sleep expert.
Once the time change happens, a lot of people find that they're struggling in the evening to stay awake at the beginning because it's much darker out. So bright light in the early evening hours can help. And also light exposure in the morning when you get up, because it's dark in the morning a lot now.
Harris says most people should snap back quickly, but some could need up to 2 weeks to make the adjustment. Later this morning, tens of thousands of runners hit the streets for the New York City Marathon. Michelle Lynch, who ran in the Boston Marathon, says she's not worried about security.
I'm not scared, but I'm definitely, like, emotional. That's the best way I could describe it.
After being canceled last year because of Sandy, more than 47,000 runners expected to take the starting line today in New York. An AP-NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll of people 50 and older finds most opposed to changes in Social Security. Close to 60% are opposed to refiguring cost of living increases or gradually raising the eligibility age for full Social Security benefits. And about as many say they want even more benefits. Same 6 in 10 favor raising the cap on income subject to Social Security taxes. This is AP Radio News. eBay apologizes for helping to sell apparent Holocaust memorabilia online. Kyle McKimmon has more.
The British newspaper called Mail on Sunday says it found items for sale that included shoes and a suitcase from concentration camp prisoners, Star of David armbands that Jews were forced to wear, and the striped uniform of a Polish baker who died at the Auschwitz camp. eBay says it's now removed 30 items from its site and has donated £25,000, about $40,000, to a suitable charity. The company said in a statement it doesn't allow listings of this nature and dedicates thousands of staff and the latest technology to policing its site to detect items that shouldn't be for sale. Quote, "We very much regret that we didn't live up to our own standards." Kyle McKinnon, London.
In college football action, the third-ranked Florida State Seminoles make a statement with another easy win over a top 25 team. Team pounding, previously undefeated, and 7th-ranked Miami, 41-14. 4th-ranked Ohio State crushed Purdue, 56-0. The Buckeyes' 21st straight win. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hey, everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Next Sunday, November 3rd, you've heard of Two Birds, One Stone? Well, we have the Mixmaster himself, Adam Birnbach. He's shaking up cocktails in studio. And have you planned your holiday travel yet? We've got the Gay Traveler in. He's got last-minute details.
That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 AM.
If talking and texting interferes with a walk down the street, imagine what might happen if you're driving. Focus on the road, not your conversation. Your brain can't do both safely. No dialing, no talking, no texting to arrive safe.
Hi, I'm Brooke Delaney.
And I'm Congressman John Delaney.
As a teen, I know not to text while driving. My dad and I ask you to focus on the road, not your conversation.
This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
In today's competitive job market, imagine not having the reading skills needed to even fill out an application. 90,000 adults in D.C. are considered functionally illiterate. It takes a lot for an adult to admit they can't read. It takes even more courage to do something about it. The Washington Literacy Center teaches adult learners to read, giving them options and a bright future. Please give back to the community by donating today. Go to WashingtonLiteracyCenter.org and make your much-needed charitable contribution. Changing lives through literacy. WashingtonLiteracyCenter.org.
Are you interested in obtaining a patent or trademark? The United States Patent and Trademark Office and the District of Columbia Public Library are sponsoring a series of free workshops at the MLK Jr. Memorial Library, located at 901 G Street Northwest. These free workshops are open to the public on November 19th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Simultaneous sessions will cover patents, trademarks, or copyrights. To register, call 202-727-1161 or send an email to education@uspto.gov.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce, and this show brought to you by VeriSolve, experts in marketing, PR, and branding for small and medium-sized businesses. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Elliot Ferguson, who's the president and CEO of Destination DC, Tom Raffa, the CEO of Raffa, Maurice Offit, president of Offit Kerman, and finally Amy Zeidel, who's the founder of Undercover Printing. First up is Elliot Ferguson, the president and CEO of Destination DC. What is Destination DC, Elliot?
Destination DC is the official convention and visitors bureau for Washington. Our job is to promote Washington as a convention destination, as well as going after the leisure market to bring tourists to the city.
I mean, that, on the surface, that sounds kind of obvious, but give us some more detail. I mean, this is the real deal business.
Absolutely, and we're a private organization, and in essence, what we do is economic development. As we look at what we do, if we're bringing people to the city, hotel workers are working, restaurant workers are working, and it brings a huge economic impact to Washington. As we know, the leisure market is the second largest economic engine for Washington as a city.
And how big is the organization today?
We've got about 63 people in our office and 4 offices internationally and 1 in Chicago.
So an office internationally, like where?
We have an office in Europe, in London, that works specifically with a lot of the tour and travel operators. The reality is, outside of the United States, most people still travel with a travel agent. So it's our job to make sure that as the travel agents are trying to influence and engage individuals as to where they want to go for their vacation, that they know that there's more to see and do in Washington than just the things in which they may think they know about our city.
And you're the president and CEO. When did you get that job?
I've been the CEO for about 4.5 years. I've been with the company for a little over 12.
And I'm guessing you wanted that job.
I did.
Why?
Well, you know, I've been in the industry for over 20 years, and, you know, I was a senior vice president, and the only other option in the organization, because I didn't want to leave Washington, would be the presidency. So, you know, as you're the number two, and folks say, well, what's next for you, and you look at the guy sitting to your right, who's your boss, and say, well, you know, I'm exploring my options. When he decided to leave the organization, that became a good opportunity for me.
So when you're the vice president and you're thinking about it, what did you want to do that you get the chance to do now?
Well, the reality is that Washington is such a dynamic destination that is so misunderstood. And when we're successful at marketing our destination, we know that we can bring thousands of people to the city. But not only that, in Washington itself, the political leadership and others just don't have a good understanding of the fact that you have to market a destination in order to get people to our city. You know, it's like Tide. If Procter & Gamble didn't market Tide, then guess what? All the other fabric softener organizations or detergent agencies are out there looking for options.
Right.
Let's go back a little bit, Elliot.
Sure.
What in your history prepared you for this?
Well, I've always been in a sales role. I think it goes back to my childhood when I would try to negotiate things with my parents, as most of us probably did. My mom would always say, you should either be a lawyer or you need to be in sales. So I've always had an interest in sales, and so this was a great opportunity for me to kind of to do that.
So you were taught how to be a negotiator by whom?
In essence, I guess I learned on my own. I understood, you know, I was the only boy with 3 sisters, and there were a lot of times whereas it was the he did it, and I learned quickly how to negotiate my way out of very difficult situations where usually I probably did do it.
But sales, you could sell Tide. Why do you want to sell cities?
Well, I think it ties into my interest in travel. I think that I've always enjoyed travel, and as a kid, that was a huge part of what we did for summer vacation. Always looked forward to summer vacation and spending time exploring other destinations. destinations. And when we're out marketing our city, and we're doing it, my next trip is in Shanghai, and they have a perception of Washington, D.C. It's White House and government, or the Capitol building. And we're able to engage them and get them to think differently about Washington. It's an exciting feeling.
So you must have grown up in this town and loved it your entire life. Is that true?
I absolutely did not. But I jokingly say I'm a native Washingtonian, but I'm from
Washington.
Well,
how long have you been
here? I've been here for 12 years.
Well, that's kind of you being a newbie.
You're right. You're right.
I mean, so what is it about this town that you like it so much that you'd want to sell it?
Well, in this industry, anyone who really wants to be successful has to come to Washington on a regular basis to interface with customers. So I'd come to Washington regularly, and I'd look around and say that, you know, and as I was living in Atlanta at the time, and I said, you know, as I look at places I'd like to live, Washington was by far, it was at the top of the list.
So why the hospitality industry? I know you like to travel when you're a kid, but how did you find yourself in the business?
Well, like most people that have been in the industry for a long time, I've kind of fell into the industry, if you will. You know, there's lots of schools that have hospitality programs now, but when I was in school, I went for marketing. I had an individual that was on the board of directors in Savannah for the organization that I worked, and he kind of engaged me and said, hey, you should consider working for the Savannah Convention Bureau. And I showed absolutely no interest. I was totally ignorant, like most people, and thought that he wanted me to be on a bus doing tours of the city, and I was insulted. You know, but fortunately for me, he kind of gave me some time to learn a little bit more about the industry. And as I thought about it and learned a lot more, I became more interested.
So where are you from, Elliot?
Well, I grew up, for the most part, on the West Coast in San Jose, California, but I moved to Savannah, Georgia as a teenager.
And under what kind of circumstances, if you don't mind sharing?
In my case, it was divorce. My family, my parents were divorced.
And how old
said,
were you?
Let's go. I was about to turn 14.
So that's a big bunch of change for a 14-year-old to come east and live in from San Jose to Savannah and newly divorced. What was that like for you?
Well, at the time, the divorce, we were all for it until my mom said, we're moving to Georgia. And I was like, well, let's think this thing through and you guys can work it out. So I grew up in that era where as kids didn't have many rights. You did what your parents said. And so therefore we were moving. And I've spent many summers in Savannah, which was totally different than relocating and living in the South. So it was an eye-opening experience about human relations and race relations in the 70s.
Well, say a little bit more about that, because you're a man of color and you've probably seen some of the unseemly side of things.
Yeah, I think growing up on the West Coast, there, you know, clearly you knew that, you know, I knew that I was a man of color, and but it was never an issue. It was a very mixed neighborhood, whereas all kids kind of played together, and it was a different environment. Whereas you just liked people because you liked people.
Right.
You know, I realized that there were race relation issues around the country, but when I would visit Georgia in the summertime, you just lived and played with the kids in a neighborhood. And that was one thing. But then when you move there and you realize that there's a black community on this side of town and the white community is on the other side of town, and they don't recognize it, very few things in between. And again, that was back then. It became very apparent.
How'd you make sense of it all?
I didn't, but I think that as most kids, I was really angry. You know, I didn't understand why I had to identify other than just being a kid that wanted to have fun.
What did you do with the anger?
Well, you process things quickly because you have to, and you realize that you can just like in the business world, you can sit on your hands and be angry and have an attitude, or you can learn how to assimilate, and I learned how to assimilate.
That's not always a given. What was going on that allowed you to go that direction instead of the other direction?
It kind of ties into how I was raised. You know, we didn't have a lot of options. It was your parents said this is what you do, and you did it, and if you didn't do it, there were consequences. And so I think that was a part of my psyche. I just knew that I lived here now. I didn't have an option of going anywhere else, and it wasn't that bad. I just had to learn and grow up and figure out exactly how to build a relationship of my own.
So what's the you come from a sales background. What's the first thing you ever sold?
Well, the first professional job I had was worked in a camera store. You know, the reality is, way before then, I was cutting grass and making my own money in the neighborhood and trying to do everything I could to make my own cash.
What was what's up with the camera store?
I always had a love for cameras. When I was in high school, I was a school photographer, and you know, my parents said I told them I wanted to play the saxophone and I wanted to be a photographer, and they said choose one. So I thought about it, and I said I'd choose the one that I could probably make the most money from, and I was able to do that, and that's why I kind of went in that direction.
And why was that important?
To make money?
Yeah.
Well, I think that at a young age, I'm the only boy in the family, and I just got tired of going shopping with my sisters. And that was the reality of it all. And I thought about it, and I said, well, if I can make my own money, then I could go on my own, catch the bus, and do my own thing. And my mom let me do that. And I enjoyed the fact that having money offered you a sense of freedom to be able to do your own things.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want this organization to be 5 years from now?
Well, the beauty of being in Washington, D.C. and doing what I do now is that I moved to Washington just a few months after 9/11. Mm. And it was a revelation. I was in a company for 10 years, and I'm a part of that generation, whereas you think you'll be somewhere for 5 years and you'll move on. And I that was really a part of how I was thinking. And I'm laying in bed, on the day after 9/11, thinking about everything that happened in the world and in Washington, D.C., and how it changed the perspective of being a United States citizen. And I said, it's time for me to make some changes. And I went back to the thought of, if I had to relocate anywhere, Washington was one of the cities in which I'd love to live. And I happened to know the CEO of the organization at the time. And without any provocation, my phone rang the next week, and he said, I have an opening that I'd love for you to consider. And I chose the job, and I moved to Washington at a time of transition, especially for our industry, whereas, people were concerned as to whether or not it was safe to move to Washington or do business in Washington.
But in my hearing for you, it was more, in addition to all that, it was also about being able to tell a D.C. story?
Well, yeah, it was really me feeling that I could come to Washington and make a difference.
In what way?
And from the standpoint of the perception, I don't know if I want to go to Washington, D.C. right now because it's not safe, and the same with New York. And so both cities and Boston, a lot of the major cities were suffering from the perspective of were they safe destinations to actually travel.
And you wanted to prove that it was.
And I felt like I could make a difference in terms of and rebuilding that.
Well, good luck with that going forward. Well, what's the website address?
The website is www.washington.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Elliot Ferguson, who's the president and CEO of Destination DC. I'd like to thank Les Smolin, my co-host, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this business call. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us for this is Isabella Fuentes, who's the marketing director for an organization called BusinessWise CPA. What is BusinessWise CPA, Isabella?
BusinessWise CPA provides outsourced CFO services, financial consulting, and M&A advisory to government contractors, small businesses, and nonprofits in the D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
What sets us apart from our competitors is that we're not just another accounting firm with temporary staffing where we send out folks we've seen once and you never hear from them again. Each one of our teammates are dedicated to one client where they can come back and forth anytime they have financial questions.
And what's the role that you play for the firm?
I'm the marketing director. I began actually doing graphic design and brand development for our firm. I developed our website, our logo, and from then and on, I've done business development.
Right. What do you like most about your company?
I like the most that we're able to really listen to our clients. As I was mentioning before, we're not a temporary relationship with our clients. It's very much ongoing. Although we're outsourced CFOs, they consider us their business partners. We're in on their executive meetings explaining how they can improve cash flow, how they can stay within their budget, and as well as look to us in the growth of their company.
Great. How can someone get a hold of BusinessWise CPA?
You can either give us a call at 301-960-5830 or check out our website at www.businesswisecpa.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Isabella Fuentes, the marketing director for BusinessWise CPA. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and that's your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce and sponsored today by Verisolve, experts in marketing, branding, and PR for the small and medium-sized company. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parker, or Parks, I'm sorry. And for this segment, we have Tom Raffa, who's the CEO of Raffa. What is Raffa, Tom?
Raffa is a firm that works to build sustainability within the community. So we work with all different size and shapes of companies, but predominantly within the nonprofit sector and social businesses.
When you say sustainability, what do you mean by that?
We try to build capacity in organizations so they can do their job better. So a lot of it relates to back office things like accounting, HR, finance, wealth management, financial services like insurance and investments.
So you kind of are a CPA firm, but you don't describe yourself that way.
A piece of our practice is absolutely CPA. So we do taxes and we do audits and those kinds of things too. But it's much, much more than that. It's grown to a lot in the past years.
Well, so give us an example of how a customer would hire you and why.
It really varies from customer to customer. I mean, the best example might be to look at one that we're doing a lot of things for. So someone that's an organization that wants to just basically concentrate on program or product or services, they would come to us and we would be able to do their back office accounting for them, their HR, their investments, their insurances, and all of their technology.
So you specialize, I understand, mostly in nonprofits. Is that true?
That's correct.
Why nonprofits?
The company was really started with the idea that we were going to be this catalyst to create positive and systemic change in the community. I believe that corporate citizenship has been dissolved around that, and it's our obligation to do much, much more in the community. So we look for companies that are making some kind of difference. You know, I spent a lot of time with companies that were trying to make money and trying to employ more people and trying to get bigger. It was fine. It's not what I wanted to do anymore.
Right.
And when did you realize that was important for you to be doing?
I was around 29 years old. I was working for a large Big Four accounting firm for about nine and a half years. And while that was fine and I enjoyed the work, it was mostly Securities and Exchange Commission work, mm-hmm. mostly around earnings per share every year. I was an audit person. And I just realized that I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life.
And so this idea came to you immediately?
It came over a period of time. I really looked at it and said that everything was designed around one single metric that would measure success, and that was finance. And I thought there just had to be a different metric for success. And,
okay.
Because there is. I did discover it later.
So what is the metric for success?
Effectiveness of our outcomes. What we do in our daily lives and how we can help improve community and people. Probably if there was much, much more of that, problems that we have, social issues and everything would be fixed. And I think nothing works better than capitalism in those things.
Where did the seeds of that get planted for you?
It's really hard to say. I mean, when I've done these interviews before, I know that it's been a little bit self-reflective. I guess, you know, I came from a family that wasn't that wealthy, but my parents still found time to volunteer. That may have been part of it. Part of it was living in a community that where there were a lot of social ills and kids were getting busted for stuff and not really having their rights honored. So there was a lot of those thoughts that sort of were there and were planted, and it took them a while, I guess, to grow.
So this whole idea of social injustice and you wanting to kind of fix the right?
Yeah, I think it had a big influence on me. I'm sure that's what got me to school, which has then directed me to a degree, because otherwise I wouldn't have been going to college without that.
What do you mean that got you to school?
I sort of found my way to through high school where folks started to tell me I could go to college, and I never really had thought about that. And not a lot of people in my neighborhood were college bound. You know, we were 18, you went and worked in a garage or something, and I had all plans to do that. When I started to apply through the encouragement of one of the guidance counselors and found that, you know, I could get in and I got scholarships, it changed the way my direction a little bit.
Earlier you gave us several examples that kind of show that you like to go your own way. But where does that come from?
I'm not sure about that. I think that there's a lot of things that I've developed in my head about where I want to be and where I think the world should be. And I think that sometimes there's not a lot of standards that adhere to that. Like the corporate world certainly didn't. And so when I went out on my own, it was really to sort of find my own way and define myself better, and then to also just work enough so that there's that as a leader, you have this vision, and you could either dictate or you could share it. And I think we've come a long way in the company where people sort of look at it and say, this is a vision I can share, and I could take it on as my own. So they don't necessarily believe everything I believe, but they do believe.
Was there a moment in time when that vision codified for you, when you just realized this is it? And it all came together, and you kind of then channeled all your energy. Was that about the time you started your company, or?
Yeah, it was probably shortly after that. I think I left thinking that, not knowing what I wanted to do. I just knew I didn't want to do that anymore. And then in about 6 or 7 months in my own business and experiencing and going through different clients and trying to figure out what it was, I was attracted to the nonprofit sector and the fact that they care about programmatically and the effectiveness of outcomes as opposed to bottom line.
You had a great quote in the green room. You said, change always happens right on time.
Yeah, I know that in a lot of cases, especially in businesses, people focus on trying to fight change a little bit. I mean, planets are deteriorating, mountains are, everything is going on around you. It's going to happen. So at least a lot of people will say, well, you have to embrace change. For me, I've always thought that it's just always timely, too. So when you had asked about, did you think you left or stayed too long, it's like, no, it was perfect. I mean, I never look at it and say I should have left in 7 years, or I should have realized all this I was 21 instead of 29.
But it's been my experience that that's not the common relationship with change. Most people resist it. They hang on too long. Why you don't?
I don't know. I think it's something that I've... You know, you said earlier, like, where, you know, how did this all happen, and did you have this realization? While I may have had this epiphany in one time, I think it's grown over a period of time. Like, my level of sophistication, say, even in philanthropy, has grown by leaps and bounds over the past 35 years of me doing it. So it's not anything that was instantaneous. It was things that I put together and influences that happened to me that said, this is a better path for me. And I do have this unbelievable balance in my life.
So you also said nonprofits are hindered by the way that we view them.
Yeah.
Expand on that.
Okay. What happens is there's nothing wrong with what we expect from nonprofits, but certainly we expect them to fix problems. And philanthropists, and a lot of times foundations will put money into a nonprofit and say, here, go fix the problem. Go fix homelessness. And it's a community issue, first of all, so you're not going to solve it by one group. It's really a matter of getting collective impact for the community to fix these social ills. But we also then hinder them because we don't like nonprofits that take risk and lose. If you put on a fundraiser and you lose $10,000 on it, that's not so good. We don't like a nonprofit to hire an executive director and pay him $400,000 a year. And all those things, we don't give them access to capital. I think all those things are sound business practices that we all have.
So you're saying if we ran them more like a real business and let them take some risk and reward them like we reward CEOs of for-profit companies, they would outperform what they currently outperform?
I think in a lot of ways that's true of a business acting a little bit more like a nonprofit too, because businesses, when they're driven only by short-term gains and financial gains, they lose their ability to think long-term and strategically about program. And so there's a good way to sort of blend both of these things. And where nonprofits are sort of, I think, cheated in that area, I think businesses, if they thought a little bit more like a nonprofit and thought about what their outcomes and what the effects of their work were in true essence, they would build better businesses and better communities.
So more mission-focused on the profit side and more execution-focused on the nonprofit side.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the nonprofits that are very mission-focused, what do you see that they need the most, and what do you provide in your services?
For us, outside of the consulting area and the things that I just went over and trying to encourage them to do things like branding and things that are not typically usual for them, there's a lot of organizations will have unbelievably great programs and have no back office or infrastructure. They won't have good governance. They won't have good technology. They're short of people because they're underpaying them. They're undercapitalized. Their accounting systems are awful. And that's how I built my company. I started as a CPA firm, clearly, but I saw these needs in other areas and saw nobody else fulfilling them and said, they need HR. There's nobody that's handling HR for nonprofits. Let's create a company that does that.
The other side of that is the corporate folks that are perhaps not performing a social responsibility. How do you encourage them to take a greater role in that?
You know, it's interesting because when this started, I thought that philanthropy and what I was doing was very private and personal. I believe now it's personal, but it's not private. I think I'm never going to be a 50,000-person company, but I know I can influence companies that are. And the way we do that by saying is, look, you know, last year we had an average of 56 hours of community service from our people. If a large company that has 50,000 people just let people off for 1 hour, think of that the change that they can affect. So it's almost not necessarily embarrassing them into it, but getting them to focus on the fact that they can do so much with the power that they have as big corporations.
5 years from now, where do you want to be?
I don't know where I'm going to be. I think if I said that I said that before, 5 years before, is I've learned a lot over this period of time. I think I'm a sponge for that, and so I think I'm going to change a lot. I think my thinking around philanthropy is going to grow. I think my thinking around business is going to grow.
There's the change a lot thing again. Yeah. It's constant for you.
So yeah.
What's the website address, Tom?
Rafa.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Tom Rafa, the CEO of Rafa. I'd like to thank Les Smolin and Jeff Parks for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
How do you know you've retained the strongest business professionals to work with you on your business? For example, an attorney who successfully handled your type of problem, an accountant who sees the big picture, a business advisor who gets it, a real estate broker who thoroughly knows the market, a commercial insurance broker who has access to all the products, an employee benefits guru who mitigates future costs, a wealth manager who makes work optional, an understandable information technology wizard, a commercial banker with minimal covenants, an investment banker who knows the business as a relationship, a staffing specialist to help build the team, even a confidential peer group with whom to compare notes. Simply listen to Executive Leaders Radio, executiveleadersradio.com, to confidently select the business leader who serves business leaders, because nobody's interviewed more business leaders from Princeton through Northern Virginia than Executive Leaders Radio. You'll have confidence in your choice and ultimate selection of business leaders who serve business leaders.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce and brought to you by Verisol, helping companies with their marketing, branding, and PR. And I'm joined by my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parks. For this segment, we have Maurice Offit, who is the president of Offit Kerman. What is Offit Kerman, Maurice?
Offit Kerman is a law firm. It appeals to mid-market businesses. It has 105 attorneys, 8 different offices. Our southernmost office is in Tyson's Corner. Our northernmost office is in Philadelphia. And we pretty well are located along the 95 corridor.
When was the firm founded?
1987.
What makes you better than anybody else? And don't be bashful.
I think we're better than anybody else because we're trusted advisors. We go ahead and we put clients' legal problems in our lap. And we say it's our job to go ahead and help our clients get through their problems.
Well, a lot of law firms will say they're trusted advisors. I get the impression you guys really are.
Well, that's our goal.
What's the difference?
Okay, you know.
How do you go about that? Not just doing good legal work, I'm guessing.
No, I think, you know, that's a given. You know, you should do good legal work. I think it's, you know, how you come across to your clients. You know, you want to be honest. You know, you want to think for the long term. You know, I can tell you our firm's philosophy is never go ahead and bill a client, you know, on a short-term basis. You know, make sure the client gets value for the legal services that you get. Clients appreciate that, and they become loyal clients for a long, long time.
Right. And the firm, you have a partner in this firm.
I have several partners, but, you know, I started with my brother.
You started the firm with your brother.
Started the firm with my brother.
And you guys are still liking each other.
We still do. Okay.
How does that happen?
You know, I think it's part of family. You know, we shared a room growing up.
I've seen some families where that doesn't happen. So
yes.
What's the secret to success here?
I think the secret to success is that we like one another. We're honest with one another. We communicate with one another. I think our parents made us do that. And that, you know, we have, both of us have a sister, and that, you know, she was part of the group as well. But, You know, I meet a lot of families, sadly, that I find to be dysfunctional.
Right.
And that, you know, I find that fortunately for my family that we were pretty good.
Yeah, great.
Most people would prefer to actually stay within the confines and the comfort of a large firm.
So well, I never
what
worked for
you to strike out?
Yeah, I never worked for a long firm. I'm sorry, a large firm. You know, I personally think that I would find that stifling. You know, large firms for the most part, you know, are based on number of hours of work. You know, the lawyers that go there work very, very hard at the beginning, and they have a formal track that they have to follow. So, you know, it wasn't my path. You mm-hmm. know, I left law school at the age of 25, and I was on my own at the time I was 26.
So you had a couple of false starts with other law firms. What were you able to do in your law firm that you couldn't do elsewhere?
Well, I could run the law firm my way.
And what is your way?
Well, my way was to go ahead and make sure that my clients were satisfied with the services that we were rendering and that we did so at a fair price. I didn't want somebody to tell me this is what you must bill per hour. Sometimes you invest in your clients and you have, you know, rate flexibility. Okay, and I think the other thing that you do is that, you know, sometimes you go ahead and represent clients on a loss leader capacity, saying that you'll grow with their success.
You told us that your mom and dad worked into their mid-80s. What were the takeaways from that?
Well, I saw a family, you know, that, you know, really believed in work. You know, my dad died at the age of 86. You know, he worked on a Friday and then died the following Monday. So he really did work until he died. And my mom's going to be 85 in November, and she still works.
You say that without any hint of regret.
No, you know, I'll tell you, you know, you learn from your parents, and that, you know, I think my parents had purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, I find a lot of people that I represent, you know, have sold their businesses and they retire, and that they think the pastures are greener. I'm not sure that they really are once they experience retirement, and retirement can go on for a long time.
Right.
When did you realize you had a purpose in doing the work you're doing?
I think I realized early on. I mean, I can tell you from the time I started my own firm at the age of 26. I mean, you know, I tell the people who work in our law firm today that in many ways I think that, you know, they have it easier because they're paid a salary and they're mentored by other people. My path was not that way. The only way I was going to bring home money to my family was to go out and get a client and to make sure the client paid me. And the only way the client would pay me is if he was satisfied with the service that I rendered.
Have you always known you wanted to be a lawyer?
No, of course not. You know, so that
how did it come into your way?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I was pretty athletic. I think I would have preferred to be a professional athlete than to be an attorney. Okay, I actually got scouted in high school by the Pittsburgh Pirates. Okay, you know, to become a professional baseball player, and you know, once they saw
what position?
Me, those days I was playing center field.
Were you?
Yeah, you know, once they saw me, you know, they said, I think better, you know, that you ought to go to college. But, you know, anyway, you know, my dad was a CPA, so I grew up in a professional service environment, and I took in accounting as a major in college.
What was the dinner table talk like growing up?
It really was not business, you know, it was all family kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so.
What were you like as a kid?
You know, I was a kid that my parents, I think, had a pretty easy time raising me. You know, I don't think I caused too many problems. I was a pretty good student, athletic in high school and things along that line.
Other than mom and dad, what important influences, looking back on it, you can give some credit to?
Well, you know, I think the big influence that I had was that, you know, as I got out of law school and went to work for two other firms and I was not successful there and then started my own firm at the age of 26, that I was determined not to fail. And that, you know, that really, I think, held me in good stead, you know, so that, you know, I'm driven. You know, from the experiences that I had then, and, you know, I'm still driven today.
We've heard a loyalty theme, that you're loyal, you get loyalty back. How does an organization get more loyalty?
I think you have to have empathy, you know, for the people that work for you. And that, you know, I see the number of people that we hire, you know, and I see people in our firm that, you know, work from paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, even then, you know, they have a hard time and that, you know, they come to us and many times they ask for loans that, you know, I think for the most part, you know, we go ahead and make, you know, we feel sorry for them. And that, you know, I think that we try to have an environment, you know, where, you know, the two biggest things is, you know, treat it like it's a family type atmosphere. People enjoy coming to work for us.
And you don't feel that you get taken advantage of by being that kind of generous?
I think actually, you know, that we don't. You know, that I think your generosity comes back, you know, as a, you know, a reward for you. because people promote you and promote your firm and get other good people to come your way.
Mm-hmm. You describe yourself as being driven.
I do.
And earlier you said that you were ambitious, but it's not about the money.
No, you know, I think we have an entrepreneurial spirit, you know, so I wouldn't call myself as ambitious as I would call myself entrepreneurial. So, you know, entrepreneurial, you know, from my context, is that we run our law firm like it's a business. You know, I think a lot of lawyers run their law firm, you know, where they tell their clients, you can't do this, you can't do that. And we're trying to tell our clients, yes, you can do this and do that, you know, and make money along the way.
So we're just coming out of a pretty nasty recession, and I'm sure you participated in some unhappy outcomes with some of your clients. What was that experience like?
Terrible. Okay, yeah. You know, sadly, you know, I had a client that committed suicide, okay, because of, you know, financial hardship. So, you know, to live through something like that, you know, is absolutely terrible. And, you know, other examples aren't as graphic, but, you know, we represented a client that was in a retail business, and they had 120 years of experience in a family retail setting, and they went out of business. You know, so, you know, your heart goes out to clients like that, and you try to get them back on their feet.
How has the business of law changed since you've been practicing it?
I think it's so different, you know, so that in the old days, you know, clients would have a great deal of loyalty with law firms, you know, and that you'd find generation upon generation saying, you know, I'm a client of this particular firm. I don't think that's true any longer. I think people are looking for value and looking for advice, and that, you know, you have to be on your game, you know, in order to be successful.
So you're growing. When you bring a young associate in to interview, what are you looking for?
You know, I think we're looking for people that have drive, okay? I think we're looking for people who have the ability to bring business into the law firm. I think we sort of take as a given that they have the intellectual capacity, you know, to do good legal work. So it's not that part we're looking for. We won't read a writing sample. We won't get wrapped up in a resume.
Right.
You know, we're looking for people's character.
So you make it sound so easy. Tell us about a really bad one.
Well, honestly, you know, it hasn't been easy at all, you know, and that I remember vividly, you know, there was a day in 1990, you know, our firm started in 1987, and that my brother was away, and I was representing a client that took me to a place of business where there was a dispute to the point where the person he was having a dispute with pulled out a gun. So, you know, that wasn't my happiest day, you know, being at gunpoint with him. And then to find out later on in the day that a partner of ours was leaving the firm and a big client of ours might not be able to pay a large receivable that
Gosh.
We had. So, you know, you learn from
triple
your
whammy.
Mistakes. Yeah, you know, it was a triple whammy. And that, you know, you learn from that, you know. And
what
that,
did you learn?
Well, you learn, you know, not to think that you'll always be successful and that you learn to operate your firm in a way that, you know, you should be careful. You know, of the expenses that you have and,
yeah.
you know, the people that
Looking
you have
back before. On your entire law career, what's your proudest moment?
You know, I'm not sure that it's one moment. You know, I'm proud of the success that Offutt Kerman's achieved, and I'm proud of people coming to me after I've given them advice, you know, saying I really appreciated everything that you did for me.
Uh-huh. Where do you want to be in 5 years?
You know, 5 years, I think I'll still be working, and that, you know, I think I'll still be doing pretty much the same thing. And that, you know, I hope that I have my health, you know, that allows me to do that. And that, I think I'm, you know, on this path.
Great. What's the website address, Maurice?
Website is, you know, OffuttKerman.com. And that, you know.
OffuttKerman.com.
Yeah, OffuttKerman.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Maurice Offutt, who's the president of Offutt Kerman. I'd like to thank Les Smolin and Jeff Parks for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Bob Dingell, who is the Managing Director of Pierce Capital Partners. What is Pierce Capital Partners, Bob?
Well, Peter, it's a small boutique M&A firm for all practical purposes. We focus on working with small companies, mostly IT government contractors, and prepare them for kind of a mid-market acquisition. In other words, these are small companies that have decided for whatever reason it's time to either merge with someone else or sell.
What makes you guys so unique in your space?
Well, we spend a lot of time working with the companies to maximize value. We go overboard because many times it's similar to selling a house. You don't decide on a Friday you're going to put your house on the market on Monday. So we spend time with these founders and owners to get maximum value for their companies.
And what do you like most about this position?
Well, you know, I've been there and done that, so I can relate one-on-one experiences to these founders and owners.
So you just help an entrepreneur who's worked really hard get their business to a stage, and then they exit, right?
They exit. And, you know, many entrepreneurs, keep in mind, take companies to a certain stage, and that's what they like doing. They don't want to manage it and grow it into the mega millions.
Thank you. How can someone reach you?
Oh, easily by either going to our website, which is, you know, PierceCapitalPartners.com, or directly. We have a cell number there, or office number, 571-934-6131.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Bob Dinkel, who's the Managing Director of Pierce Capital Partners. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce and brought to you by Verisolve, helping small, mid-sized companies with their marketing, PR, and branding. My co-hosts today are Les Smolin and Jeff Parks. And for this final segment, we have Amy Zeidel, who's the founder of a company called Undercover Printing. What is Undercover Printing, Amy?
Well, besides that, I really shouldn't divulge that information.
Because you'd have to shoot us or something like that?
Yeah. Okay. Undercover Printer is a marketing products distribution company. So we do trade show displays, promotional items, apparel, and paper print.
How did you get the idea to do that?
I was a marketing director for a financial company that had five divisions and had a million balls in the air, had a super tight budget, and they wanted me to do a lot with that budget. And I learned through that how difficult it is to make deadlines and make it happen, along with doing all of the other creative and planning all of the events that a marketing director has to do. So when I started Undercover Printer, I wanted to be that product support for a marketing department of a company or an event planning department of a company.
Because you do it well, because you find the work interesting, why?
We do. We don't sleep, so our clients can. We work by deadline, we make it happen, and we do it well. Our products are very high quality, and we go above and beyond to make sure we get our clients the best product for the best price.
So you like it best when you're under pressure?
Absolutely.
Why?
It's fun. Keeps
what
you
makes
alive.
It fun?
You fall asleep otherwise.
Is this your first business that
no,
you've started?
It is not. It is not. I had two salons when I lived in Buffalo in my 20s.
So this is kind of a big departure from that. How did you come to be here?
It is a big departure, but it's still owning a business. There's a lot of similarities. And a lot of what I did in the salon business was design and marketing and promoting, and that's very similar to what we do now. So,
go ahead.
So I started my first salon when I was 23, just by accident. I just really wanted to do my own thing. I was working in another salon that didn't do things the way I wanted to because I'm stubborn. And then started another one when I was 25 or 26, I can't remember, and just expanded to offer more services and become a bigger player.
What did you learn about yourself back then? Because most people, I don't think stubbornness is on a list of qualifications to actually start your own business and be successful. So what did you learn about yourself back then that said, I can do this?
I've always been the jump-in kind of person. I didn't think about it. I said, I'm just going to do this, and would, within a week, had a place rented and figured out what loans I needed to get to make it happen, and found the right people and just went for it.
Where'd you learn all that?
I have no idea. I really don't. I think I learned a lot from my father, being a hard worker and just putting your head down and setting a goal and going for it and doing whatever you have to do to make that happen. But my inner entrepreneur, I'm not really sure where that came from.
Sounds to me like you learned how to learn.
True.
So what's behind that? An innate curiosity, a drive? What? What's more true of you, more curious or more driven?
I think I'm more driven. I'm very creative, so I always want to create things, which entrepreneurial is about creating things.
Sure.
Driven.
Where did the creativity thing start showing up?
since I was very young. I've always been artistic.
Give us an example.
I was always artistic, drawing, painting. I played piano since the age of 7. I actually, before they even let me take lessons, I was watching my brother play and copying him and playing the piano when I was 5. And just, I've always had that.
You were telling us about your Polish grandmother. What were your takeaways from her?
Oh, she was great. She was a little 4'9", little ball of fire. Stubborn. I'm her. Other than height, I'm a little taller. But she was stubborn, and she kind of set herself apart from her generation in things that she did. She didn't take no for an answer. She wasn't your typical quiet wife for her generation.
If I was interviewing her, what would she say about you?
Oh, she'd just be here kissing me and hugging me.
What's it like to be the person that can do no wrong in the eyes of someone else?
Oh, yeah.
You think that may have had something to do with the confidence you have now?
Pure love. Could be. Could be.
You also talk about a great uncle. Tell us about that.
So my great uncle I met, he lived down in the Florida Keys, and I met when I went down to Florida to get my scuba certification. And I had somewhat known him through the years, but never really spent time with him. But I was able to stay with him and get to know him. And I think I've always had a fascination with older people and hearing their stories and their life journeys, and I've learned a lot from them. And so he was a very successful businessman, and he taught me so much about life and living it. And here he was going on 90 years old, living down in the Keys, living life, you know, Margaritaville, and that's what it is down there. And I said, you know, this is something I'd like to do down the road. And coming from Buffalo, that was a very big stretch in between.
So he gave you the idea that I could leave this place?
Yep, he did.
Yeah.
You call your company the Procrastinator's Choice. Is there something special that you're looking for employees that kind of help you deliver these last-minute deals?
We all have to be on our feet and be able to handle all the balls that are up in the air. Some of the calls that we get are companies that have a booth at a show maybe a week out, maybe 4 days out, and didn't remember they had it, and we have to put together that show for them in that amount of time. We have to drop everything and work on their project. So we only hire people that are on their feet.
I want to go back to that moment with your great uncle where you sort of got permission to leave Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little more about that. Why was that important to you?
I never thought about it. I had a business. I never thought about, really, to me, I had already made a success of myself. I was on Main Street in the wealthiest part of town. We had a very busy salon. We had a staff, I think, of 8 or 10 working, busy all the time. And I never thought about it. And when he first mentioned to me, he said, oh, you know, why would I want to do that? And then I really started seeing more and more. I visited him much more often and just started to see that there was more to the end of life, looking farther than where I was at age 28.
Right.
And so that's.
So looking back on it, because you listened to him, how are you different today?
Oh, completely different. Moving to a big city from a small city changes you completely.
How?
Culture, experiences, energy. Buffalo's a great town. The energy in the D.C. area, it's constantly, you know, new industry and building, and everywhere you turn, even in a bad economy, there's new buildings going up. You don't see that in a smaller town.
And for some reason, that's really exciting to you.
Absolutely.
Why?
Creating.
Yeah, creating.
We're
again.
Constantly creating.
So go back to your inspiration for that. You had mentioned a story about your mom when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm. The year I graduated high school, my mother graduated college. She stayed at home with us as long as as we needed her to. My father worked all the time in order for her to do that. And then she realized that she wanted to get her psychology degree and go off and help people. So she did that. It took her 8 years, and she graduated the same year I did. We both had caps and gowns together.
And how did that impact you?
Oh, it taught me that no matter how old you are, you can always reinvent yourself. You can always follow your dream. Does not matter.
That's fabulous. You told us in the green room that Undercover Printing isn't your last startup. You've got something else you've got to bring into creation. What is it?
We do. Undercover Power is my give back, and that is a gift company that is all about helping girls and women become the best versions of themselves. We have a product called the Empowergram, which is a basically a gift that you can give another girl that she can keep close to herself in private or wear out in front, that are just words of encouragement and empowerment to make her a little stronger through her day.
And this would be a gift a woman would give another woman?
It can be, or you can buy it for yourself. We've had people that have purchased them for themselves.
How did you get the idea for this?
Do you remember underoos? When you were a kid, they were superhero underwear that you could wear, and you had your underoos on, and you felt like you could tackle the world. Well, I thought, well, why don't we have that for women? And we all struggle with so many things. Whether it is a tough life at home, having an illness, for teens, the bullying, tough times in school, boyfriends, all the stuff that women go through. Wouldn't it be great to have a little message that's tucked away somewhere that you're wearing every day to keep you stronger?
It's a fabulous idea. How do you want to get this to the market?
We are working on working with girls groups and trying to get more out on the internet. I am looking for other groups that we can promote it to and help get the word out about it. It's very, very new.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to be in 5 years?
5 years, I would love to be a full-time CEO of Undercover Power, out there helping girls and women become the best versions of themselves.
What would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is, Amy?
Moving out of Buffalo, I think, was the hardest thing. Only I didn't give myself a whole lot of time to think about it, and It's the best thing I did, too.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
Proudest moment, I think, was the day that I realized that the company that I built was exactly what I started out to do.
Which company was that?
Undercover Printer. I'm right exactly where I started out wanting to be.
Well, congratulations. What's the website address?
Undercoverprinter.com.
Okay. We've been speaking with Amy Zeidel, the founder of Undercover Printer and soon Undercover Power, right?
Thank you.
I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parks, for helping me with the interviews today. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show, including Elliot Ferguson, President and CEO of Destination DC, Tom Raffa, the CEO of Raffa, Maurice Offit, the president of Offit Kerman, and finally Amy Zeidel, the founder of Undercover Printing. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartzer, your host. We'll be talking to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
The March of Dimes and AFSEA Nova invite you to the 13th annual Heroines in Technology Gala. This event will honor women who exemplify leadership and are making a difference in our community. From CEOs to rising stars, this year's finalists will be recognized for their significant volunteer contributions at a Black Tie Awards presentation on Friday, November 8th. Heroines in Technology is sponsored by Harris Corporation. All proceeds will benefit the March of Dimes mission to give all babies a healthy start in life. Since 2001, the event has given awards to 73 heroines and raised more than $1.4 million to support the March of Dimes. To learn more about the March of Dimes and to get your tickets to Heroines in Technology, visit marchofdimes.com/metroDC. That's marchofdimes.com/metroDC. And help celebrate the March of Dimes' 75th anniversary.
Ever wondered how you can make an impact on today's young women? Bernadette's House is pleased to announce its official opening and inaugural networking and fundraiser event November 14th at historic Oakland Manor, located in Columbia, Maryland. Bernadette's House is a newly launched 501c3 organization that's dedicated to providing teenage girls with a structured and safe after-school and weekend program while promoting self-esteem and self-worth. For more information, visit BernadetteHouse.org or call 410-707-2020.
Join MD Bio Foundation and the Hispanic Heritage Foundation to learn more about the many STEM career opportunities at their Leaders on the Fast Track Career Symposium. The event is aimed at Latinos, African Americans, and other minority high school juniors, seniors, and college undergraduates. The STEM Career Symposium will be held Saturday, November 16, from 10 till 2 at the Johns Hopkins campus in Rockville, Maryland. For more information and to register, visit mdbiofoundation.org.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or